Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is Nicole Hannah-Jones, creator of the 1619 Project from the New York Times Magazine. The project makes a case that you don't often hear in history textbooks, that slavery was foundational to America. So it wasn't surprising that we ignited a fierce debate among historians about these issues. But that's the power of the New York Times, to spark an important dialogue with bold, rigorous reporting that forces us to examine our assumptions. To learn more, go to nytimes.com/worthit.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jonathan Savage, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 20th of February, these are our main stories. Facing global criticism, Japan defends its handling of the coronavirus cruise ship.
I do admit that the Japanese government could have done much better jobs. I don't think any other government could have been well prepared.
Meanwhile, two die from COVID-19 in Iran, but the disease slows its spread in China. More bad news for Boeing after debris is found in the fuel tanks of several brand new 737 MAX aircraft. Also in this podcast, after a series of gas attacks in Zambia, the country's first lady breaks down on TV.
I'm appealing as a mother of the nation. I'm appealing!
And could ammonia prove the green alternative to diesel that could transform the world's shipping industry? It's a long time since any one issue had so many governments and international agencies so exercised all at once. The COVID-19 coronavirus is causing tensions between nations and anxiety within them. Look at Japan. Criticised by the US Centers for Disease Control over how it's dealt with a quarantined cruise ship with 3,700 people on board, nearly 500 passengers who have tested negative for the new coronavirus have started to disembark, but the US, Britain, Canada and Australia are placing anyone from the ship returning home in an additional 14 days quarantine. Speaking to the BBC, the Japanese Prime Ministerial Advisor Tomohiko Taniguchi said the situation would have taken any country by surprise.
I do admit that the Japanese government could have done much better jobs. But I have to say, I think this has given us a very important lesson that if you get 3,700 passengers on board in a closed environment, you have to be extra cautious. And I don't think any other government could have been well prepared to contain the disease.
Elsewhere, there have been demonstrations in Ukraine over where evacuees from China should be housed, and two confirmed deaths from the disease in Iran. We'll hear about those shortly. But first, more about what the World Health Organization has hailed as tremendous progress in the battle against the virus, not least in China, where the outbreak began. Our China media analyst Kerry Allen says there's now optimism there too.
I'm definitely getting the sense today that China is emphasising that it is now on the downward curve in handling this coronavirus. So in recent weeks, all we've seen are increased cases being reported, more and more and more cases, tens of thousands of cases even. And instead today, what we're seeing is that the number of cured cases and cases where people have been discharged from hospitals have actually surpassed the number of new cases. So there's optimism now that there are fewer cases being reported throughout the country. And in fact, areas like Shanghai, major city, they're reporting zero cases in the last 24 hours. So other than Hubei province, where this all started, where there are more than 10,000 cases, there is a real sense that things have slowed down and are under control in the rest of China. And that's very much reflected on social media platforms like Sina Weibo, which is the equivalent of Facebook or Twitter, where users are talking about how they perceive things are getting better and better. And hopefully we should be seeing the back of this.
Kerry Allen. Meanwhile, as I said, the first two deaths from coronavirus have been reported in Iran. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher gave me the details.
We heard earlier in the day an announcement from the Iranians that there'd been two cases reported, They were the first in Iran. There have been very few across the whole of the Middle East. In the UAE, there have been 9 cases reported so far. There was one reported in Egypt, and then today they actually said that the person has tested negative. Very shortly after that news, it emerged from Iran that 2 people had died from the disease, or at least the preliminary test that they'd undertaken seemed to show that that was what they were suffering from. Now, the information that was given was that they were old and that they had other complications. They died in a hospital in Qom, a major city. It's a great centre of Islamic Shia philosophy and literature. Lots of pilgrimages there. It's no indication given so far as to how this disease got to Qom. And we know also, the BBC has learned, that there are a number of other people being held in quarantine in that hospital and that the authorities in Qom are looking at measures to take.
Our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher. For the past few weeks, it seems that many Zambians have been living in fear after a spate of reported gas attacks on people. People say that unknown attackers spray a gas that makes their victims dizzy and faint. Zambia's First Lady Esther Lungu made an emotional appeal for the attacks to stop.
To the people that are behind this gassing, I'm appealing as a mother of the nation. I'm appealing!
Well, I've got more details from our Africa editor, Mary Harper.
These attacks started in Zambia's Copperbelt region, and they've now gone to every single part of the country. And it's very, very bizarre. What we do know is that there are these gas attacks taking place. No idea what the chemicals are. The police say they know what kind of gas it is, but they're not going to disclose it to the public. We do know also that troops have been deployed, partly to try to put a stop to these attacks, but also to try to stop riots, panicked people running about, and they have killed between 3 and 8 people who they suspect of being perpetrators of these attacks. We also know that the attacks have been taking place in strange places like schools, where children have been falling unconscious, in people's homes, and in the streets.
In some cases here, the obvious questions are unanswered. The who, the what and the why. What do we actually know as fact?
Well, this is the thing. In terms of the why, there have been so many different possibilities put forward. Some people are saying that people are being sprayed with this gas so that then they fall unconscious or become dizzy, disorientated, and then people rob from them. Other people say that they're being gassed, they become unconscious, and then this is being used by people who are involved in traditional medicine for witchcraft, that actually blood is being extracted from them while they are unconscious. Other people say it's the governing political party that is doing it to kind of make it look like it's the opposition. The opposition says exactly the opposite is happening. Some people are even blaming the police. So it's like everybody's being blamed, but there is no clarity, I'm afraid to say, on who actually is carrying out these attacks.
Of course, we heard the First Lady just before I spoke to you appealing for the attacks to stop, very emotional, obviously. What is actually being done to try to stop these attacks?
We have got the president ordering that the troops now have been deployed. So that is something that's actually being done in a concrete fashion. And whether they succeed either in stopping these attacks, it seems to be because they're so widespread and so unpredictable, it'd be very difficult for them to do that. But they're also there to try to maintain public order because of this sense of great social panic that's gripping the country. And also there's another problem, which is social media. If you go on Twitter and you look at the images that are being posted, the kind of theories that are being put forward, it really is just adding fuel to the fire.
Do we know exactly how many people have been attacked and whether they're suffering long-term damage?
There hasn't been information about that, but it seems that once they're gassed, I mean, some of them do fall unconscious, that's what we're being told, but I haven't heard anything about anybody like falling ill for an extended period of time.
Mary Harper. More bad news for Boeing. The troubled plane maker has announced that the 737 MAX airliner is facing a new potential safety issue after debris was found in the fuel tanks of several new planes. The foreign material included rags and tool parts, for example. Our transport correspondent Tom Burridge says that's not uncommon in the industry, but the discovery will add to the pressure on Boeing as it tries to repair its damaged reputation.
It's really embarrassing for Boeing, this. The objects could have caused damage, I guess, if the planes had been sold. I think the important clarification on this issue with the Boeing 737 MAX, because it's the latest in a long line of problems which have surfaced since those two crashes, one off Indonesia, one in Ethiopia. This problem, I think, isn't a systemic problem with the aircraft. We know about other systemic problems with that plane, which Boeing is trying to address. But this is more a sort of issue with new aircraft which had been built and the systems which Boeing had in place to stop that happening, which ultimately didn't prevent it. And Boeing has come out quite clearly and said this is unacceptable.
Tom, of course, we know that the 737 MAX had this technical problem, this electronics issue, which led to the crashes. What's the latest in terms of the plane actually getting back in the air, convincing regulators, airlines and passengers that it's safe to fly again?
Well, what's happened more recently is you've had quite a difference of tone from European regulators, EASA, aviation regulators, and the American Federal Aviation Administration. I mean, both saying that they will expect the highest level of scrutiny for this aircraft before it's allowed back in the air, but the Europeans clearly pushing Boeing much further, and ultimately Boeing was trying to resist additional training for pilots in simulators. They had to concede on that. That's now going to happen. And several US airlines are not expecting to have this plane back into their schedules till the middle of this year. But I wouldn't be surprised if it's pushed back even further than that. The other issue is convincing us, the travelling public, that the plane is safe. And I think Boeing has a job on its hands. This story has been running and running. We've heard about problem after problem, things being left in the fuel tanks of certain aircraft. It's just the latest. And therefore, I think there is a crisis of confidence in this aircraft. And this is, broadly speaking, I think the biggest scandal in aviation in modern times.
Transport correspondent Tom Burridge. UN officials are hoping that talks between the two main warring sides in Libya can still resume after the internationally recognised government withdrew on Tuesday. The move came after the port in the capital, Tripoli, came under missile attack from insurgent forces. Rana Jawad reports.
The prospect for a meaningful dialogue, which the UN hopes could bring about a lasting ceasefire in Tripoli, appears increasingly difficult. On Tuesday, Libya's internationally recognized government announced a suspension of talks in Geneva until it sees firm responses against its assailants, according to a statement from the Prime Minister's office. Tripoli's port, which receives major imports of food, fuel, and other necessary goods, came under heavy artillery fire from forces commanded by General Khalifa Haftar much of the day on Tuesday and well into the night.
Rana Jawad. Scientists here in the UK say they may have found a new way of reducing the carbon footprint of international shipping by replacing diesel fuel with ammonia. Ammonia produces no carbon dioxide when used in the engines of ocean-going tankers, but it does produce another greenhouse gas, nitrous oxide. And that's where the British research could provide a solution. Professor Bill David is lead author of the Royal Society report.
Ammonia is an excellent fuel. We know it as a fertilizer. It basically helps feed half the planet. But it's very similar to natural gas, methane. If you take ammonia, and this is a bit of a chemistry lesson, you've got nitrogen and three hydrogens. With methane, you've got carbon and four hydrogens. So when you actually, you know, combust, you put a methane in an engine, you get CO2 and water, carbon dioxide and water. We don't want that. When you take ammonia and you combust it, you get nitrogen and water. You get air and water coming out the back. So that's why we want to go to ammonia, because it's giving us a chemical fuel like methane, about half the energy content of methane. But the big upside is it's nitrogen coming out the back of the car or whatever, not carbon dioxide.
But it does produce nitrous oxide, which is a global warming gas. How do you mitigate against that? That's key, isn't it?
Right. OK, so at the moment, what we do in cars is that we've got AdBlue to take the NOx emissions down. And the active ingredient of AdBlue is ammonia. So that if you take ammonia and you react it with these NOxes, these nitrous oxides, then in fact it converts to nitrogen and water. So what we need to do is to develop the technology that means that we completely zero that as it comes out. And that is actually something that I am particularly working on at the moment. And once we've done that, we got the cleanest of fuels.
So if that's feasible, then a huge problem from pollution from ocean-going tankers could be wiped out overnight. Is the infrastructure there to change quickly?
There's tens of thousands of tons of ammonia sitting in ports around the world. So the infrastructure, you know, is there already. You know, what we need to do is to turn that ammonia from one that's producing 500 million tons of carbon dioxide a year into one that produces nothing. And that's going to take us at least to 2040 to get that.
And it's that timescale which is the problem, according to some environmentalists. If it's going to take that long, would we not be better advised spending time developing cleaner renewable resources?
I don't think that there is a cleaner renewable resource that we can work with. At the moment, we can actually create ammonia by splitting water to hydrogen and oxygen and then using the nitrogen from the atmosphere to make ammonia. And at that point there's no methane, there's no carbon in there. Now, that we can do already. What we need is to upscale that. The cost of these electrolyzers that split water, they have to come down. But already, if you think of a ton of ammonia costing about $250, it's not expensive. With these electrolyzers, the green ammonia is probably sitting at $400 at the moment. You know, we can both reduce the carbon emissions on existing production of ammonia, and at the same time, you know, bringing in over the next decade this green ammonia solution that uses electrolyzers.
And what noises is the industry already making? Is it on board?
The shipping industry is on board. Most of the ammonia producing industries are on board with this, yes.
What about the capacity for the developing world to gain from this?
When we were talking about green ammonia, there are two main costs. The electrolyzer to split the water, and then there's the cost of the electricity. And if you look across the world and say, where can we get cheap electricity? Somewhere like Morocco, somewhere between the tropics, much sunnier than here in the UK. But what you want to do is you want to bottle up that sunshine. And the only way you can really do it, and the only way that the international shipping companies know how to do it, is to turn it into ammonia and ship it across the world.
Professor Bill David talking to Paul Henley. Still to come in this podcast, there's anger about the death of a Good Samaritan motorbike rider in Kenya.
We really condemn the event. What they did is not humanity.
The German far-right party AfD has apologised for publishing a colouring book with racist and xenophobic images. The book was handed out at an event the party's parliamentary group had organised on Monday. Our Europe editor, Risto Pico, reports.
The book's illustrations were unquestionably offensive. Gunmen waving Turkish flags and black men with bones in their hair harassing women. But initially, the Alternative für Deutschland sought to defend it as satire. However, by Wednesday, the wave of criticism had become so strong that the party admitted it had made what it called an organisatorial mistake. Its decision may also have been influenced by a police investigation into inciting hatred and a parliamentary one into whether public funds were used in publishing the book. The case is another blow to AfD's efforts to portray itself as a mainstream party.
Now, have you ever had a situation at work where someone much younger becomes your supervisor? It seems that businesses hungry for the latest social media skills are bringing young people into the workplace, often straight from school. When managed badly, such appointments can create resentment among older colleagues, but when done successfully, it can lead to a win-win situation. Our correspondent Dougal Shaw went to visit some British companies to see whether there is a formula for success.
We've got the video with the changing names and... Yeah. We've also got the one about his accent.
Taking part in a daily team meeting, that's Kirsty Shepherd. She's 18 years old.
Knowing that I had to come in with so little experience and kind of tell other people older than me what they should be doing was quite scary, yeah.
She's working at an agency called Birthdemo that promotes musicians. It involves a lot of social media skills, which is exactly why she was brought in, as her boss, Alex Jobling, explained to me.
It's primarily about just having an understanding of how young people are engaging with social media. Unless you are experiencing that every single day, then you won't understand what young people engage with.
On one of my first days, I was sitting just with Alex making an advert and he asked me to write the copy and I just typed it out with no capitals, no punctuation or anything. He was like, oh, how come you don't use grammar? And I kind of explained to him I just did it naturally because that's what I would post if I was posting it.
It was so engaging. It was our best performing ad we'd done to date.
This is a trend happening across the country. young people, many of them recent school leavers, being snapped up by companies for their social media skills.
My name's Theo. I'm the operations manager of Down North East PR. I'm 20 years old and I've been at the company for just over a year now.
In Bournemouth, Theo Middleton is in a similar position to Kirsty. A key part of his job is to help bring colleagues up to speed on their social media skills. Some of them are much older than him.
He's younger than my younger son. I was working before he was born.
For older colleagues like Charlie, it can rankle that such a young person has been given responsibility and authority over them.
The first thing that struck me was that he was a really bright spark and he was young and enthusiastic. But it was a little bit different when I then knew that not only was I going to be working alongside him, but eventually he was actually going to be in a management position over me. That took some real adjusting on my behalf.
Someone who has seen this phenomenon firsthand is digital consultant David Taylor.
Many businesses are starting to utilise the services of what we would refer to as digital natives.
While young people may have natural digital skills, he thinks the natives have a thing or two to learn as well.
A lot of them are not particularly good at talking on a phone. They're not particularly good at presenting. That's a lot of feedback I'm getting from businesses.
But he does think that when businesses manage to cross that age divide, it can be a very powerful force.
If you have a two-way street where you can have the older people mentoring the young about soft skills, and at the same time, the youngsters can help mentor the older people and say, well, actually, this is TikTok, this is a YouTube channel. You get this virtuous situation where the older and the younger generations are working together rather than working against each other.
Lots of comments, lots of shares, lots of likes.
Okay. It's not
just forging that two-way street is exactly what has allowed Theo and Charlie to build a successful working relationship, as they explained to me when I sat them down together.
Charlie's got lots of experience in many things, so I'm always learning about tips and tricks from her, especially her work in the charity sector.
There's prejudice from both ends of the spectrum, I think, in society. You can be ageist because someone's too young or ageist because someone's too old.
Dougal Shaw with that report. If you're in Nairobi and want to get somewhere quickly, jump on a Boda Boda. They're the motorcycle taxis that buzz through the streets all over East Africa. They have their critics. Selective observance of traffic regulations is one frequent complaint. But what happened to one Boda Boda driver for not obeying the rules has shocked Kenyans. Emmanuel Igunza picks up the story.
This began when this taxi driver, motorcyclist, was answering a distress call in a neighbourhood in one of the slum areas. And when he went to the neighbours, he found that a young boy had fallen into the river and was nearly drowning. So he helped him and then rushed him to hospital. And when he reached the hospital, he left his motorcycle just outside the buildings. But then when he came back, he found that the security guards were really angry with him. There was a commotion between him and the security guards. And then a policeman who was in the hospital approached them. And it was during that fracas that he was shot in the chest and he died.
How did people react when this all emerged?
Well, there's been a lot of anger in the country. If you look at social media, people have been really condemning the police because this is not their first case this year that police have allegedly shot innocent people. They have been constantly accused of using excessive force. I also spoke to the chairperson of the Cyclist Association, and he told me that they were taking this case to the authorities. Let's hear more from Mr. Samuel Nganga.
We really condemn the event. What they did is not humanity. Our interior minister, Mr. President Matiang, should come clear and the police boss and give the clear indication of the man who did this. All the border borders in Nairobi County will not operate until we get the justice of our member.
Yes, and these motorcyclists have been going throughout the city today protesting, and they say that they are going to stop all businesses in the city. The police have not issued an official statement regarding this incident. We also know that the motorcyclists did take this complaint to the Internal Security Ministry and also to the Police Oversight Authority, which is a civilian body that oversees the police, but all these bodies haven't still given an official statement of what happened. Or what will happen to this policeman.
Emmanuel Igunza in Nairobi. Police in Australia are investigating the deaths of a former rugby league player and his family after a car was allegedly set on fire. Rowan Baxter died along with his wife and their three children. As Daniel Mann reports, the news has shocked Australia.
A devastating morning for emergency services that rocked a quiet suburban street. The three little children didn't stand a chance.
Smoke rising from a car on Wednesday morning in Brisbane. By the time the emergency services reached the scene, Rowan Baxter, who was 42 and had reached top flight rugby with the New Zealand Warriors, his two daughters, aged 6 and 4, and his three-year-old son were all dead. The children's bodies were inside, his was outside. The media arrived soon afterwards. Detective Inspector Mark Thompson from Queensland Police spoke to them.
It's a horrific scene. It will be a horrific thing for emergency services, police, fire and ambulance to deal with in the coming days.
One witness said that Baxter jumped into the car his 31-year-old wife, Hannah, was driving before grabbing a knife and stabbing himself to death. Others who saw the car burst into flames said that she got out, her children trapped inside, shouting that her husband had poured petrol on me. She died in hospital from severe burns. The police said it wasn't certain how the fire started, so it would be inappropriate at this stage to describe what happened as a murder-suicide. The authorities want to be cautious, but there's growing speculation about the couple's private life. It's been reported they had separated. They had run a gym.
I'm Rowan.
And I'm Hannah. And whether you're just getting started or whether you already have some experience, we would love to hear more about how we can help you improve your health and fitness journey.
Pictures and videos they posted on social media show them together in peak fitness, and Rowan Baxter regularly playing with his children. He recently said how much he missed them. Whatever the truth was about their marriage, what happened was, as Australia's Prime Minister Scott Morrison tweeted, devastating news. He urged anyone who needs mental health support to call Lifeline, a suicide prevention helpline in Australia.
Daniel Mann. Travel is often about broadening your mind, experiencing new cultures, or simply lounging on a sun-kissed beach. Then again, it can also be about this. Especially if you're British, it seems. Brits not only travel more than other nationalities, but new research suggests a surprisingly high proportion are for pre-wedding blowouts, sometimes called bachelor or bachelorette parties. They're known here in the UK as stag and hen do's. Research by the environmental charity Hubbub found that half of all flights taken by young British men are for stag parties and a third of women's flights are for hen do's. Coletta Smith is following the story.
50% of the flights taken by men between the ages of 20 and 45 were for stag do's. The figure is slightly lower for women. It's 36% of that same age group. But that's still a huge percentage of those flights. Now, what this report terms them as is kind of frivolous flying. So we're not talking about people going away for their annual 2-week break or the big family holiday. It's simply a weekend if you're going maybe from Friday to Sunday for a stag or a hen do. The most popular locations that came back in this survey were Amsterdam, Barcelona, Benidorm, Ibiza, Dublin, Paris, Berlin. If you live in one of those cities, I am sure you are well used to seeing people from the UK. In fact, more than half of those surveyed who said yes, they'd been abroad on stag and hen do's also complained about it. So they said that it felt like they were going away for too long, that it was too expensive, that it involved too much travel. So actually a lot of those people saying they would rather have holidayed in the UK for those parties, but instead when the bride or groom decide, or perhaps it's the person organising the stag or the hen do that decides where it's going to be and everybody else just has to suck it up.
British tourists don't always have the best of reputations abroad for their relationship with alcohol, but there are now going to be concerns, I expect, about our reputation as far as our environmental impact is concerned.
Yeah, exactly. When you look at how these sums add up, so swapping a flight from London to Las Vegas and instead going to Manchester on the train for the stag or the hen do for the weekend, that's the equivalent to one person going vegan for a year and a half. And that's somebody classed as a heavy meat eater. So it's a significant change. Swapping Dubai for Edinburgh is the equivalent of giving up driving for 7 months. So when you're putting it in that context in terms of the carbon emissions and the kind of changes that lots of people are wanting to make in their everyday lives, actually just cutting down on that one flight could make a huge change.
And Brits travel more, as you say, than other nationalities. That fact combined with this study, what does it tell us about British society?
Well, I suppose a couple of factors have combined at exactly the same time over the last decade or so. One is that really cheap flights are now available, and that's happened at the same time that bride and grooms are getting older. So people are getting married maybe late 20s, early 30s. That means that they've got more disposable income. They are more well-travelled as individuals themselves, so they're more likely to want to get their pals together and go a bit further afield. So because those two things have happened at the same time, there's now a lot more pressure on people to go a bit further, to spend a bit more.
Coletta Smith. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jonathan Savage. Until next time, goodbye.